First agenda item is approval of last month's minutes. Any changes by committee members?
Maybe we can see next as a second.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, that's been approved. We have a second agenda item, persons to address the board, and I think we have John Miller.
Yes, sir.
Yes, excellent. Great. Glad you could make it. It's your floor. I'm sure you know what it's all about. So just for the information of other folks that may be here, one of the things that we've been talking about for several months now is the idea of bearing the power line and some of the issues. We've had some discussions, but none of the discussions have been moved forward to some of the expenses and so forth. So again, we invited Mr. Elliott, Progress Energy, to come here. Originally scheduled, I think, for last, something got delayed or something like that. So again, we're very delighted to have you here today.
Great.
Perhaps you could enlighten us about the pros, cons, expenses, and what perhaps you need to do.
Right. Well, first of all, thank you for your flexibility allowing us to here. And I also have Daryl Penny here from Progress Energy. Daryl, operations supervisor for Curie Beach. He has what we call a local self-operations area. So any of the things that are power-related in this area, Daryl is ultimately responsible for. So he is here very technically. We can talk about these things. But, when I was first contacted by city manager to come and discuss this, they were just wanted to come and get a general overview about what was all involved with the potential for taking overhead utilities underground. And, of course, like all undertakings like this, they're very complex. There's no short answer. But one of the things, there's no short answer to any of that because each of these things are very complex and each community is a little different in what they have. But bottom line, the underground provisions for these courses for Progress Energy is basically have our legal portion of this is through the North County Utility Commission. They basically state how we do our systems and how we can charge for the systems, and then when we do various things like this, how you have to do the charges and those kind of things. So first and foremost, there is a rough estimate of what it takes. It's very expensive to go from overhead to underground. And a couple of components of this, Gary, you can jump in at any juncture of this. But the bottom line with the utilities, it's just not Progress Energy that are on these particular poles. It's also the cable company. It's also the phone company. So they also have to be engaged in this when it goes to any kind of underground process. And on top of that, there's also the actual residents and businesses that would also have to be involved in this process because currently they have the weather hedge. You see the boxes on the side of the house where your power comes in. Well, those are right now currently for overhead for the most part. And for those customers, if you did do something underground, those folks would have to convert that over and have it set for underground, which in some instances require additional electrical inspections and those things for commercial facilities. But those expenses would be bared by the residents or the businesses for that. A lot of folks, the other piece of going underground, the exception is everything goes underground, and that's not true. There's a lot of facilities that stay above ground, transformers, switch gears where different circuits come into play, big green boxes you see, those are part of that have to come in, so that involves getting right away to be able to go on someone's property because you have to get those off the streets and those things to be able to put. Those facilities have to go somewhere and in close enough proximity for voltage requirements and those things. So going on someone's property and putting a big green box and trying to find that kind of space is also, and certainly in these communities, is at a premium. So I didn't know how far you wanted to get in and questions you had. I really didn't come here just if there's specific questions and what have you. And Daryl, did I miss anything kind of in your mind of things you went through? Or
No, that's the biggest thing we have is right away. Like John said, we're going to place the facilities and transformers and square green boxes because we found in beach areas, particularly in beach areas, where lots are small, no one wants to do any of it. So there are right away issues to begin with. Plus that, and the homeowners and business owners, in most cases, were all required to rewire their equipment to accept underground versus overhead, go through the inspection process in order to accommodate that. Other things are where do we place the facilities? In the street when we dig, you know, we have to remove asphalt or remove concrete. concrete, you know, to put things in. We typically ask the governing authority to take care of those things, so we don't want to be responsible, you know, in the future for that. So that there is a typical issue we run into with doing these conversions.
And then on average, on some of the projects we have done of recent, for some underground, overhead underground, it was about $300 a foot. Overall cost, you factor that in.
For your cost?
Or full conversion cost for our cost, that's not any other utilities.
Right.
And no other certain things.
For just, you know, that's a critical issue. I think a lot of people in the audience may have some questions.
Sure.
Might I suggest that just as a, so we can kind of move, is that, you know, they, you know, maybe we'll each have a question up here, and if it's okay, I'll open up to members of the audience to ask questions, if that's okay.
So,
no, I mean, I didn't
mean
to interrupt. I see people raising their hands.
I have a project called Mission Complex. I don't want to bore you to tears on the variety of it from an engineering standpoint, from a construction standpoint, and then just the cost of who kind of is involved in the process. That's what at least you get the flavor of how many different folks and how many different entities are involved when it comes to going underground the facilities that are currently overhead.
I have one question. You mentioned that some communities are, in fact, doing this, and you are involved with putting them on the ground. So it seems like there is a process of doing that, and communities are, in fact, doing that.
In the most part, Bill, they're not doing entire communities. They're doing little sections, or there's a certain area around a particular part of town where they want to do a certain block. They're not doing blocks upon blocks in normal. They're doing a specific block, and it's something that the municipality or someone has come forward with the funding has come to Progress Energy to do this, and therefore we haven't seen wholesale change outs in communities. It is really just smaller projects.
The Elizabeth Town is a great example of that. They're in the process now of converting a portion of that underground, but just that small area around the downtown.
Is the primary problem funding, or because you mentioned several different issues, you know, residential, commercial owner objections, or whatever. From your experience of looking at Elizabeth Town, maybe some other one, is the primary issue funding? I mean, if the money's there, we can do it.
Cost is always the determining factor, and from a state standpoint, it looks better. Now, from a preparation standpoint, in terms of when storms hit, and that's always an issue, and I think the general problem is that underground is more reliable, but in fact it may not be, because they get flooded, you know. If it's just wind, yes, you're in good shape. But if the tidal surge comes in, and you've got electrical equipment under salt water, it doesn't function, and it damages pretty severely. And the underground takes a lot of time to repair it, but never it lines up. So from a restoration standpoint, maybe very little benefit there.
It is a cost aspect, and then secondly, a lot of the residents, because they have a cost involved with two of the business when they do their conversion, put their facilities on their house or buildings. That is a cost they bear.
So, put this cost in perspective somewhat. I'm basing this on memory, so around 10 years ago, we gave an estimate to convert the south end of Riceville Beach from the wings south to the end. That was in the $15 to $20 million range for that. That's the type of money you're talking about. That's why I say it's pretty cost prohibitive. When you start pushing in underground facilities in an established area, there's a lot of conflict with water, sewer, foam, fiber optics, other things. It's just tedious, drawn out, expensive work to do.
And then on the backside of that, one of the different things that also is the type of power lines that we have, whether it's the main feeder line, the main line, or if it's a single phase line, or a single phase line coming all these different kind of lines also, which also impact all that when you're looking at major trunk lines coming through.
Let's go ahead and ask questions up here, and then we'll let the audience.
When you're talking about getting the right of way, I think the town has easements on properties. Do you find that in most cases those easements are good enough to get a right way to put your equipment on if you're going to bury equipment? Or is it where you do fringe a lot on actual residential property and you have to get the residences to give up their permit. Because, you know, most cases the town has an easement. I think we have plenty of contracting easement from the center of the road that we could go in for just this purpose, utilities and so forth.
Yeah, if there was some way to stand on the width of that easement, when we put a pad down the transformer, so it's a square transformer, about 3 by 3, you know, a couple of feet high on a pad, and you can't put the edge right against the curb because of traffic, you know, something like that, right. It's just got offset a couple of feet. So, you know, if your right way extends to about 10 foot beyond the curb, then we have enough to put it on that right way.
Okay.
And with that being said, having right away doesn't really eliminate someone not wanting to.
Right, I understand. And last question. In that 15 to 20 million estimate, was that for everything or just your cost, electrical cost?
I'm sure
that's just electrical cost. That is electrical cost. That includes CATV or
communication. Thank you.
You know how many miles that
one? I don't recall. And I said, you know, whether it compares to how much you have here or if you. It's hard to say.
Can the transformers, can they go on private property?
Yes, if they have an easement. Well, that's how it's signed, the easement for that property owner.
Yeah. And what about the location of them, too? I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the Pear area. Mm-hmm. Can those be remotely set? I mean, that's a small area down there. Would you be able to set some transformers maybe across the street? Is that possible? Or do you have to do three buildings, one transformer?
It depends on the distance from the transformer to the load center and whether we can put a big enough wire into it to meet voltage drop requirements. So it has to be on a case-by-case basis.
Because you have to keep
it. Typically, we get it within a couple hundred feet. Then we can get
it. So it's certainly away from the pressure voltages and get the voltage at a certain level at all.
But that one little strip of the red light down to the pier, it's possible to take those transformers and maybe remotely set them somewhere for me in that area.
It's only going to get up to a couple hundred feet of the load center.
All right.
You mentioned a minute ago that you said roughly $300 a foot to bury the lights. It's a very rough estimate. Right. Is that just the front machinery? That up between the cable and the phone, that's not happening. That's strictly front machinery. That's just based on some things like the Lucas panel we did. That's not, you know, the factory in some of the larger feeder lines that come right down through Cherry Beach here on Woodland 1 there. So, you know, like I said, it's very complex. It's figuring out which of the cables are there, what you have, what space, where they can go, the lights, the easements, you know, what those kind of impacts are going to be in there to study. But that's just a ballpark figure to give you some kind of idea of what takes place.
Does it matter if what was like?
Say, is there a minimum that you start a project, a minimum distance that you work on?
Yes, and I'm trying to think of what that is. It's, I think it's 1,200 feet.
Yeah.
I'm going to maybe write that full regulation out and look at it.
Is it
just very quickly, I'm struggling with some numbers here. How do you reconcile these numbers here? You know, you said you had a $15 million quote to do 10 years ago.
10 years ago.
I look at $300 a foot and say a mile is 5,000 feet. I'm getting $1.5 million.
Help me out.
I'm seeing a factor of
10
that doesn't.
Okay, that's going to be a last mile, too. If it's a mile down the beach, we've got a trunk line of a mile being around, and then we've got branch lines coming off that. It's not road miles. We're talking about line miles.
Okay, so it's a total. So, say, in one land mile, as you put it, you would multiply that by a factor of 10 to get the total. I'm just like to think, right? Like if we're thinking about, well, we want to do a mile, a land mile down the road, I would multiply that by a factor of 10 to get all the offlines, basically.
I don't know what factor you could use to do that.
That's why we have to do a full engineer study.
Engineer study costs money.
Yes.
How much?
I would say for a project like this, it's really required a deposit at least substantial. Bring an engineering crew down here and do the line by line process, do all the engineering out here, it's very expensive.
In the neighborhood of $34,000.
Is that
Yes, I did. I
have
a few questions.
Is that seen
available? Hi, Mark.
Yes, sir.
Having seen Russell County, and of course they're different from y'all, change all of their barrier islands to under. Yeah, I don't know if y'all are familiar with what y'all are getting.
Sure.
My question is, most of that was done with trenchless technology. Now, why couldn't you do most of the same thing here? And also, we have a great deal of our township already with underground utilities. Okay? That's north of K, almost all of them. So we're talking primarily south of K in our business district. Okay. I'm on the board here, so that's sure. What I'm asking. The study and everything else, the 30,000 hour you were quoting.
They're not quoting us.
Would that be for the whole town, or would that be for
the whole town? This is the first we've even heard of any of even looking at thinking about. Well, I was not provided any information on the area you're looking at or whatever. It was just to come and talk at a high level about the items involved. We have not provided
any. This is generalities. Without knowing the exact scope of the project, it's hard to determine that the actual engineer estimate or what the total cost would be.
Yes, sir.
Or how dense the area is as you're converting the underground density as a factor.
Getting back to the barrier island thing. The Ford County Electric down there was able to get a grant. Okay. Or would you be able to get a grant to supplement that?
And no, we would not be able to. And the reason is that no guy will probably have a better handle of exactly the process they all went through working with London Electric and what have you. But, the Electric Membership Corporations and how they're set up are totally different than how investor-owned utilities are set up.
Yes,
sir. So I do not know exactly the contractual arrangements that London Electric South and Oak Island and the federal government all got in together on that.
But I understand.
I'm not, but for Progress Energy, we do not have access to federal grants.
I understand that it was FEMA, and the reason they were doing it was to minimize the storm damage later on. Okay? Now, it's also my understanding that if you keep these vaults above grade, like we do, that we see all around here, and not try and bury them where they'll get drainage and water fall in them, that lessens the amount of water damage that you would have. Am I correct or wrong?
It depends on the storm. It depends on the height of the transformers and the storm surge you get.
Yeah, the reason I say that, we're pretty lucky here in Cherry Beach. Our elevation is higher than most any other elevation along the coast. So I would think that would have something to play into this mitigation afterwards as well.
Sure.
Your other question on trenchless technology.
Yes, sir.
If we come in and replace underground, we use trenchless technology where we can. In some cases, depending on the infrastructure that exists in the ground, you may not be able to. In most cases, we can now.
Well, yeah, I think if we probably got no guts to come out here. But I don't know, you know. And went back to what we know that we have in the ground.
Yeah.
We may be able to come up with.
And we've worked around those issues in the past, but we do use trenchless technology where we can. But it's important.
And, we do this kind of work. It's not unusual work. Do it all the time.
So, yes, sir, I know.
So it's nothing that's just new and different. It's just an aspect of understanding exactly what the panel's looking to do. And see what kind of funds
the tail
may have.
Well, that's it. It is a big money issue.
It is a big money issue.
But before we go to Jim, I just one more question. Do you have to do the work, or could we go out for a bid and have somebody else do it?
Yeah, we would need to do the work.
We're responsible for the system and the liability breach of the customer. So.
Jim?
I was just curious. Have you had experience burying cable for communities that are coastal, like Cherry Beach?
Trying to say what we've done in the morning. We did some in the land base, but on a small scale.
Most of all the beach streets have been on a small scale basis.
Yeah, small scale being like a couple blocks to the downtown area.
Because the downtown area has been most of the projects we have done recently have been mainly a downtown block or two where they were doing some downtown renovations. And as part of the renovations, we were doing sidewalks up or things like that.
Understanding that, that you weren't given a whole lot of, in terms of size of scope, like Karen talked to us, is there, you feel comfortable that if we were to think about varying power lines, whether it be just in a small scope area like our downtown or a broader area, maybe along the main drag, is there a way of researching through other organizations that have varied lines to know the cost differential of repair over a 10-year period? What it costs you currently to fix power lines that are above ground that are being damaged in windstorms, rainstorms, hurricanes, things of that nature, compared to underground, so that we could maybe apply those cost issues in this overall scope of the project?
But we can say historically our maintenance on the ground is more expensive than maintenance to repair over the glass. Because although it may not fail as often or may not be as much wind damage, when it is damaged, it's a lot harder access because it's underground, so over there where you're readily accessible. It's underground, you have to dig up the streets and
And to that point, I think as you look at this project, as you ponder the project, look at it, it'd be important, I guess, to get the phone company and the cable company, because I know they got some phone line out here. That's got to go somewhere. It can't be in the same area as the power line. So as you start looking at getting rid of those buildings at the same time, so you can have some idea of that. That may be trunk line for phone companies, another issue of trying to find space to get the separation required by code from being around here. We always do joint trenches and doing those kind of things. That's an important part of the business. They've got to go somewhere to use because they're currently on joint use with fire teams. They have a contract for joint use.
The 1,200 foot minimum, that's that you had mentioned that's not road, 1,200 foot of road, not. Is this a 1,200 foot minimum line? Is it 1,200 foot of?
I think that's one road. Let me research that and get you that exact number. We did that qualification on it.
Three hundred foot line. It's not a road.
Yeah, and that's just a general overall estimate. If that 9 miles is bulk feeder, it's very expensive. It's single phase tap, it's less expensive. So it depends on the scope of the project, what kind of mix you have between three phase and single phase. That's just a rough follow-up.
And that's why I just wanted to give you guys a general idea. If you were moving forward with getting funding, and you had funding, we would then come out and do a full engineer study and give you a much more accurate picture of what it was going to take from time-wise, cost-wise, those kind of things.
If you could get the minimum, that would help, because then we at least would know it.
I guess the minimum, and then what a minimum engineering deposit is based on. Let's say you want to do a 3-block downtown area versus the entire, everything inside the city limits. I can put together some estimates to give what the estimates would cost and some ballpark or something like that.
What the minimum
is. But Alan, who do you want us to email that to?
So, for clarity, it sounds like we are interested in moving forward. It would be contingent upon the town to decide the scope of the project, basically.
Right.
And then the next step is to, it sounds like not really getting funding because you don't know how much funding until we have an engineering study done. So the next step probably would be to negotiate with you as to the cost and the aspects of an engineering study to get an idea about what the cost would be.
Right.
Is there other regulations with CAMA and your transformers? Sorry. As far as setting transformers, can they be in the CAMA setback? How does that set back?
I'll talk to that.
Because the engineers factor all those things in when they're looking. They actually do the design, and it's all schematic, and they do the design, so when they hand it off to construction crews, it's just like a blueprint or anything else. It already has it done, and all that stuff, and the permitting, and the things are all necessary, because all that's worked through as you do your easement liability work.
And then that's all part of that, so you put extensive engineering study.
Yeah, because then that's the other thing is you're doing detailed engineering stuff. We did one with Wilmington, and it was having to have the right-of-way get approved and start talking to residents and businesses, because if you're going to do it, you have to know that this can go there before you start designing it. You got to know that this particular piece of equipment can go on this spot. So you've got all that pre-work to do before you come back to do it, because you can't just make an assumption that we're going to put that bigger, because as we have learned, that's not always the case and not always can be expedited.
Other than the electrician, they were business for the residents, that's how to reconfigure your database and the web head and get the search going around. Is there any additional charge from proper standards to that resident for doing that, or is that all figured in the price right there?
That's calculated in prices of the
right. And they would just have to do the conversion piece of that application. And one of the things we found in some other municipalities, and I don't know about certain communities, but the electrical inspections, if they change the interface, it normally triggers a different inspection, and that has been problematic for some folks, especially some older businesses that have not had one before, and they come in and they find they have some things that probably aren't out of code, since they're changing over, they have to bring some of those things back up to code. And well, that's something the business owner, we normally find out the businesses and the business owner has to make those changes. Well, that's not a final change requirement, that's something in the code to the city is going.
What about interruption of service?
Typically just during the conversion, what we'll do is come in and get all the or underground facilities in a section. We'll typically face it, depending on step up. But we'll get the underground in sections, get it extended through the house, and then try to have as short an outage as we can on each individual customer.
Okay.
If they're not over, 4 to 6 hours anyway.
And we provide notification of when that's going to be and for how long, to give the resident and the business owner enough notice. But when we try to do that, we try to do that for the least impactful time possible.
All right, any questions? Any questions, additional questions from the audience?
Okay. I have a question. A lot of the existing street lights are on your utility poles. Do you leave those existing utility poles or replace them with decorative type poles?
We'll replace them with a pole, and of course, because of the building's falling, we'll replace them with a standard underground pole. It could be a wood pole. This underground, it would be the same ones there.
In the business district, it may be a different type of decorative pole or something.
Well, that would be up to the municipality, because the municipality owns, at least the lights. So the municipality can decide if they would like a different fixture or a different lighting, but they want to go back with something that's similar. But that's normally a town call.
Which would impact the price
that the city would pay on a monthly basis.
Yeah, that wouldn't necessarily impact the conversion cost, the underground conversion cost, but it would affect the monthly lighting cost.
The lighting
cost.
Yeah, that's definitely.
Because we charge the poles and lights as a package when we install them.
Right. On your prior lines that run along the main streets here, do you see that the location of transformers, even if not going to have the transformers on the poles, even have them on the ground,
yeah.
It looks like a small dumpster system.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you see that, or had experience of that being a problem in communities that have very limited space?
Yes.
Is that one of those sitting in front of the house?
And that's what I spoke to earlier. No one wants an area all right, but we did focus on the side of the house.
Right.
And we find space.
And we find that some businesses in very tight spots like this, in Carolina Beach, what have you, if you go to a business and you have to put one there because of proximity to the loading, then sometimes it'll take up a parking space or possibly two. And you start taking space or two. The business owner doesn't like that because parking spaces are a premium.
Well, not even that, even some of the the residences along that area, that's going to be, I think, a bigger challenge.
It will be an issue.
We have yet to have a positive development side challenge. That's what it's true. And that's why I said that's what we do, so that work with the front end. But I also, in past experience, that the municipality is still kind of debating it, still looking at it, they want some more firm prices. You start talking to residents or something beforehand, and then the residents can get.
For those types of bigger, primary transformers, physical size, just so everybody can get a perspective of how big that would be.
A standard residential pad-mount transformer is roughly 3 foot by 3 foot by 2.5 foot tall.
But the bigger ones, the ones...
Okay, the commercial ones could range up to 10 foot wide, about 6 foot tall, about, you know, 6 to 8 foot deep.
Depending on what that's providing.
And the pad itself sits on is about a 8 foot, 12 foot pad.
What's the large cave getting that in now? I'll say 3 foot.
Pacific concerning with this, and
I felt like he might be able to explain them pretty good to y'all, and so I asked him to come tonight. So I have a few I'd like to ask him on up there.
Sure. Before we do that, you mentioned Carolina Beach. We have that at Curie Beach, too, because I own a couple properties over in the Keys, and that's exactly how we have it at Curie Beach in the Keys, where those are townhomes. The property underneath the townhome is deeded specifically to the owner of each side of those townhomes. So we do have a precedent in Curie Beach.
Well, yes, sir. But there's nothing in the ordinance that specifically addresses a lot by a lot basis, a lot on a case by case basis. That was still as a subdivision.
That's a plan.
Plan unit development.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Yes,
sir.
Great.
Yeah. And could you state your name and again and address for the record?
My name is Terry Randolph. I live at 906 North Fort Fisher. I'm a neighbor of Allen's and drive by and admire this place all the time. My wife thinks she feels jealous. Of course, no, excuse my language. Of course, hell, all right. I talked to John about this a couple months ago. I spent a year, literally 12 solid months, trying to find some refinancing for our condo. And, you know, it's never been like a case of creditworthiness or, you know, income strain, you know, debt to market size, property ratios, any of that sort of stuff. It always comes down to the new federal regulations governing Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and FHA, which buys these loans. And the new changes are that they prevent any of us who are owners right now or want to become owners of a two-unit condo system from being able to get financing. And the reason for it is the banks, as we all know, they sell these loans, but nobody's buying these loans. The federal government's not backing these loans. And it's the result of the designation being condo. And as we've seen on the news, you know, forever, all the overdevelopment condos in so many other areas, Miami in particular, and places like that, they've come up with some generalized rules, but if they check off the box condo, and then they find out that you own more than the maximum allowed amount of condos in a condo complex, that kills any further advancement of your loan request. And this is the case for everybody that's going to be doing this. Now, it's going to become a case that's going to be a dominant issue for a lot of people in this area if we leave it as a condo designation in the future, because, you know, folks have bought their places 5 years ago, or, you know, a lot of their loans are going to be renewing here shortly, and some of them in 3 years and 7 years. But if the folks who are buying in the booming years are going to find themselves, if they haven't already, facing this issue. Now, the two minimum requirements that are creating a problem are the following. One regulation requires that no single owner can own more than 30% of a condo complex. Well, those are only two units. Everybody violates it. And every single loan application, no matter what, it always gets killed in that one item alone. But the second is that no more than 30% of the total of the condo units can be held for investment in a condo complex. Now, what that does is it creates an inadvertent odd shift in power. All right, because to begin with, let's say for instance a situation which is, you know, I don't know if it ever happened, but seriously possible. You have two owners, again, and you have the fellow who owns condo unit A, and he wants to sell. Condo unit B wants to buy cheap. All right, condo unit A. They get a listing agent, they list it. Okay, all of the guy that owns B has to do is send a written notice to the listing agent and the owner that they are holding their property for investment. And the new rules for investment property designation is that if you rent your property at all, all right, where in the past was very flexible, very wide open. Now, if you claim any income revenue at all on your taxes for that unit, it's now an investment property, whether you actually want to classify as a second home or not. So now you have a guy that owns number B, really has control over the sale of the other unit. All right? Because now the listing agent and the owner is by law required to advance that information to the lenders and to the prospective buyers. Now, when the prospective buyer comes to buy this, any one of these units on Prairie Beach, the only real buyers that are possible are cash buyers. So someone's going to have to come here and borrow, I'm going to pay $1 million for a unit, knowing full well that when they own it, that unless they own both parts, all right, they actually can find themselves trying to sell in 5 years in a situation where they don't have control at all. Because if their neighbor is renting their unit, and this guy's living here full time, the guy that is renting this unit literally has control, okay, major control over what happens to his neighbor's unit. You follow? And it's just an inadvertent kind of weird thing that's come from these regulation changes, right? When it's combined with the fact that we designate two-unit attached single-family homes as condo complexes rather than townhomes or duplexes. You know, and even in the tax records here in Hanover, they designate as D1 half of duplex. And yet in the town, you know, Curvick Beach regulations, you know, it's considered to be a condo to condo owner. And so my request for the job was to try to bring this to the council's attention and see whether or not a solution to which I think would be proper, that would be to change the designation of townhomes, a condo, or single family attached, any of those different designations, and find a way to do it so as to avert what really is going to become a terrible circumstance, not just for all of the property owners, you know, but for, I think, for the county and the community as well. So, you know, that's fine.
Just a real quick question, because it sounds like you've done a lot of great research on this. Is the issue a semantic issue? Or is it a semantic issue, for example, can you just get around this condo issue by just calling any two unit condo a townhome or duplex?
Correct.
Okay. Or is there something deeper in the sense of like the ownership that you can't call a duplex or a townhome or an attached single family unit unless there's ownership of the underlying property by an individual owner?
From what I understand, it's just a designation. I mean, literally, I've been told I'll be very frank, I've been told literally if I can get the city of Prairie Beach and an attorney to get these things redesignated as townhomes rather than condo, there's no problem. It eliminates the problem. Duplex, townhome. It's all very simply nothing more than the semantic designation of the property being a two-unit condo complex. And in fact, when you speak to underwriters and speak to mortgage bankers about it, they literally have a bit of a... It's a bit difficult for them to envision a two-unit complex being called a condo. You know, they go, well, don't they? I mean, they will query me, but don't you really mean it's this? Don't you really mean it's that? And, you know, just because it is kind of an anomaly, you know, I guess in the world of finance.
And then again, that's the question I think for the attorney is whether you can have it, whether it needs to be called a condo because you have joint ownership of property, whether that's really the fundamental issue here from a legal point of view. I understand it from a financing point of view, probably from an insurance point of view too. If you call it a duplex, it probably goes into a different category. But the question, you know, I think for you know the attorney is to. I mean, can we do that? You know, simply change the definition, or is there an underlying requirement regarding the deed of the property underneath it?
And I can address some of that this evening. I did do a memo in response to John's request, and I had not seen the memo that John put together this afternoon until tonight.
Just so you know, we can let Terry sit down. Is there any questions for Terry before we open this up for discussion?
chat with you next week.
Okay, thank you. I will listen to our response to our
I'm not sure that I understood this correctly. But didn't you say that something about 33%?
30%.
So that would make the only time you could do that would be on a quadruplex. Just want to make that clear. So we're not talking about duplexes. We're talking about making duplexes into quadruplexes somehow. Or not?
No. The financing, you can't get financing if one owner owns more than 30% of the structure. But when you have a two-unit, quote, condo, each one owns more than 30%, so it throws it into this kick out of the box for financing. Mm-hmm. So that's...
This is part of the new regulation.
That's according to your Fannie Mae regulations, right?
Okay. Well, that really puts us in the bill.
Yeah.
And it puts the owners in the bill.
For sure.
Okay, how was it?
Well, let me get my handout. Is memo. And John and I just talked about this yesterday. We talked about it in the past, but in terms of addressing it again, we just talked about it yesterday. And I really just put this together this afternoon. But I kind of agree with the gentleman about that it's really just nomenclature. And just conceptually, I'd like to, since I just put this together this afternoon, to offer just to poke holes in between maybe now and the next meeting. But what I propose are some changes to the ordinance which would address that issue. And basically, a condo, there's a Condominium Act in the state statute, and it describes what a condo is with the common area and so forth. So there's not a whole lot of flexibility there. But my concept, and I believe it's accurate, is a duplex is basically just two attached single family units. They can be separately owned, they can both be owned by the same. You can have all different types of arrangement with the property around them. So a duplex could conceivably be a townhouse arrangement, or it could be a condominium, or it could be neither one. It could be basically treated just like a single family house, except maybe some parking regulations that might apply just as duplexes, in the zoning ordinance. So, what I have proposed is that you take, a duplex, and that if it, so long as it does not have to be a condominium, and where it would have to be a condominium, is if you had, let me put it a different way. If you had a situation where the area around the building, the two-unit building, is also split, where there's a property line that runs right in the middle of the property, and it cuts the front yard in half, the backyard in half, and the two units, that can be called a townhouse, but you have created two lots. And so the problem there is that's fine, but each of those lots is going to have to meet the minimum lot size. So call it a townhouse if you like, if that's fine, but it would have to each, because you created two lots, that's going to have to meet the minimum lot size. And I just put in here that there would be a provision, if any provision applies for a variance for a smaller lot, then that's a possibility. Again, the one where everything's under common ownership, a different scenario where somebody just has a lot, they come in, they build a structure on it, and it just happens to be two single-family connected units, you really don't have, you can just call that a duplex. You're not going to have to record anything, no declaration of condominium, no declaration of townhome. It can just be called a duplex and meet whatever, parking regulations and anything else in the building code would need to. The other scenario would be where you come in, you've got a parcel, and some of this would be a lot easier to draw, I guess. But you came in, you had your parcel, you built your structure with the to attached single-family dwellings on. And you split it up, and I think this is the scenario we discussed before, where Unit A is owned entirely by Unit A's owner. Unit B is owned by Unit B's owner. And the area around it is common area, owned by presumably a homeowners association formed by the two. I think that could be either one, and that seems to be the key, most pertinent scenario. That I don't see any reason you couldn't call that, and it sounds like there is precedent for it already, that could be called a townhome. You have two townhomes with common area around it, and then that would not be treated as a subdivision. It sounds like that's what Carolina Beach does. You just say, well, you essentially still have the one main lot. You would have some deeded restriction that's got to remain common area. And so you do prevent a scenario where down the road it could be split up into two non-conforming lots. So that's kind of conceptually where I was coming from. And I think it addresses his concern. Now this would be, I think, normally just in your initial approval process. I don't know exactly what you do with something that's now been recorded as a condominium. But I think as far as the town is concerned, if you want to convert it to something called a townhome, as long as that common area is protected, indeed it says that it can't be recombined into two separate lots that don't conform with the zoning ordinance, I don't see a problem with it. But in any event, given the concern that was raised and given what I know about duplexes, townhomes, and condominiums, this seemed like an approach that might.
I've got two quick questions. It sounded like that to call something a townhome, you would have a deed issue of the property underneath it. Again, like the Keys in Interior Beach. But it's simply a nomenclature, a semantic issue if you wanted to have common ownership of the land, you could just designate what's currently designated as a two-unit condo, you could designate it as a duplex. Without any underlying change of the ownership of the property. That's what I'm hearing.
Well, there may be some, and that's really more of a legal real estate law question than a municipal law question, is how do you convert in terms of what you got to file with the register of deeds and things like that. Because if you have a condominium, chances are you have a declaration of condominium. It's been set up legally as a condominium. There's a condominium association, property owners, that all that's been, filed with the register of deeds as a condominium. I think if you just bring something in and say that, it converts it to a townhome, and say it's all been converted to a townhome, I don't think from the town approval standpoint you'd have a problem. But from a real estate law, as the property owner who is going to his real estate attorney and say, we've all got together and decided we want to change this to a condo, or to a townhome,
or a
duplex, or townhome, either way, getting something other than a condominium, there may be challenges to that, but that's not something the town necessarily could resolve.
The second quick question I had, and again, I'm familiar with certain states' condominium laws, and it has to do with ownership of, like, outside walls, inside walls, and things like that. The ownership of the space inside walls and stuff like that. For North Carolina, if I think that these two-unit duplexes, basically, I think everybody recognizes what they are, if they're recorded as condominiums, does that trigger a North Carolina law in terms of exactly that? That the condominium association technically owns the exterior walls, and the folks that own those units technically only own the interior walls and the space within those exterior walls.
I think almost all condominiums would be set up under the North Carolina Condominium Act, and that tends to that type of thing. And so that's where it
is. Well, it's not an easy transition.
And I guess that's something that I didn't necessarily pick up on as this was coming through, is that you're talking about existing structures that have been set up as condominiums and trying to convert up. That's going to be not unlike the Progress Energy scenario a little bit. That's going to be more complicated than someone coming in with a parcel and saying, can we create this into a townhouse? scenario, it again would be largely between the existing property owners and their real estate attorney to say, how do we undo what we've done and come in with a proposal?
And we as a town have to have a mechanism by which they could and make that application.
Exactly, and be satisfied that it will work, you know, from the town's perspective.
Any questions? Paul.
Barry.
I'm just speaking from an experience I had prior, but what you said is right on. I used to have my wife and I had a half foot duplex for a town condominium, actually, is what they call it, on the ocean. And during Fran, both sides had separate insurance, and we both had to cover our own repairs. Anytime the outside exterior was painted or whatever, there had to be an agreement between the two of us to split the cost. The same way as when we rebuilt the walkway going from the house back out to the beach. I mean, that's been my, I live in Salem County House now. I mean, that, I agree with what you were saying. That's the, what I have experienced.
Is there an issue, I guess it's a question for the attorney, is there an issue that further complicates this if there's a swimming pool on the property as to when you start talking about common grounds and changing condo association bylaws and covenants, how a pool then comes into play? Does it complicate it further?
Well, I would think, you know, you would not want to try to do the scenario where you said you don't want to, split up that common area into two lots. You know, you'd want to go with the option where, you know, you have townhouse A that's owned by the owner, much like probably the condo would be, and townhouse B is owned by, you know, owner B, and then that whole area is still jointly owned.
I think you need to, yeah, John, the way it's set up now, John President, along with the ones that had the pools, Jim, are, I think, are deeded to one of the units. Now,
right, well, first, if you got one pool and two units, that essentially becomes common area. Then it goes into a commercial pool, public place. However, if you have a county who controls commercial pools and all, they've been approached in recent years about having one pool for one unit. And so they've actually given me the proper documents to have recorded and done, to where that pool is designated to that certain unit and for that unit only.
So it could be either or, depending on when paperwork, if you would, was
said. Yeah, let's say
Terry put it within your records.
Yeah, let's say Terry put it, well, he got a pool out there. Let's say he wants to sell outside of his unit, but he wants to keep it full for himself. I'm simply going to register it needs and have a document drawn up.
Let me address this. Robert Calder, who's a real estate attorney in your town, everybody knows him, is the closing attorney that we use, and he's also the fellow that I'm going back to on this. And to get the designation from condo and into anything else, it takes a day, 2 days. There's absolutely no difficulty in legal issues at all, with the single exception that we have no other bucket to dump it into. All right, we can unwind all the documentation for the condo homeowners association, all that sort of stuff. No difficulty whatsoever. It's a single file. What we had trouble with is finding the other designation. Make it into a duplex, make it into townhouses, and create the new designation, the homeowners association that owns the common areas around the duplex or around both of the townhomes. And in that circumstance as well, a pool would be part of the responsibility of the homeowners association to maintain, just like it is in the neighborhood or in any other place of that nature. And the dues would be required of the homeowners of both of those units for maintenance and repair and stuff. But the only thing that is holding anything up on this is not having another, I don't know, I mean, some food, another bucket, plus a designation to move this designation from condo into. Right? And Robert's looked into this thing at length, and it is absolutely not a problem whatsoever.
So, if we use the scenario of what's under the building is the rest of the property comes here, call it out. I mean, worst case scenario is that the meteor hits the house, disappears, and now you're left with a lot that can be built back as a townhouse, or it can be converted back to the same thing.
The only way that could happen is for the lot to be redeeded as one single lot or one single lot.
But if that owner, those two owners decide that they don't want to build back to it, they can sell that property as a single family.
Absolutely.
And if you deed it back to one.
Correct.
So there is no splitting down the middle, making non-conforming lots.
There's no way, I mean, the only split that's going to be done is under the structure. So it's still one big lot, but it's got two little parcels inside. I guess it's a good way to describe it.
I would suggest for purpose of brevity, because I think this is a very important issue. One question I would ask is you say that the frequency of calls is increasing. Is it in your opinion that something we should deal with fairly quickly to come up with a mechanism / amendments to the zoning to deal with this issue quickly?
Well, yes and no. One, I don't want to jump into something that we're going to redo in 6 months. But as Mr. Randolph said, I think it's an issue that's going to get larger here in the near future. And as I told you earlier, I get called all the time. It's either regarding insurance or financing. But insurance is a big thing. I mean, that's the more calls I get are about insurance and financing.
Barry, and then we'll go to the discussion and we'll decide.
I guess my question is primarily to John. How many situations do we have that, since our last boom of duplexes that we filled all over the place, how many instances would we be?
Every single one of the duplexes that were built in the last 7 years, probably.
So we're talking about how many?
A lot.
150. I just wanted to get a size on how big this balloon was.
One thought I'll treat as well when this is out. Because changing the designation is not free. I mean, the homeowners have to pay attorneys and fees and all that sort of stuff. There will be some homeowners that probably won't need to for whatever their reasons. There are going to be a great many of them. They're going to find themselves in a situation where they're going to have to. Right? And they're going to elect to go ahead and get this designation changed to duplex or something else. So as to not lose the property and therefore close the property. But it's not something that the city would need to go and do a mass change, all would be necessary is for there to be an ordinance that provides for the homeowners to come before the board, make the request, make it to John, some sort of simple mechanism, and as long as their property meets certain minimum arrangements, then it's already been sort of set to assist, but it not be something that the city or John or the council has to deal with 175 situations all over 4 months or 6 months or all at once. A mass mailing would create nothing but mass confusion and all that sort of stuff.
Well, then my next quick question would be, if we do change the ordinance, do we create 200 non-conforming duplexes out there?
Because you can still do it as a comment because it would still be compliant with the code. We're just basically we're looking at creating an exception to that or another section of that ordinance that says, well, you can do it this way also if you want to.
That was kind of the theory. That was operating under. You have, you can call it a comment, that's still fine, but here's another option.
Okay.
One more comment that will close it for public comments and have a discussion up here. Barrett?
My only point,
not the first one, Matt.
No, only the last either.
While he's speaking,
we have Trump here, Dean.
Yeah, while he's speaking. Going back to what Alan was talking about and non-conforming, and the one instance that this is actually came up here in Curie Beach, when it was they originally were permitted as condos, somehow along the way they were turned into townhouses, and they were non-conforming. But is your interpretation of this going into any problems like Al brought up about being non-conforming if you change this description?
The one,
because I think it will be, I think Al's got a good point.
Well, the one corollary I put in here all along is if by townhouse you're creating something where, you know, again, just the simplest version is you got a new property line that runs right down the middle, you know, the yard, the middle of the building, and the front yard, you know, and if those two halves don't meet the 5,000 square foot minimum or whatever applies, then, you know, that would not be approved by the town. Not because you're calling it a townhouse, but because you created two separate non-conforming lots.
Right.
That's small. And I remember what the question was. Does that mean we have a variance?
Well, and you know, again, it's just as all the other
some sort of a variance.
You know, I didn't look through the whole thing. I mean, the one that, you know, that John mentioned briefly, it may or may not apply would be the PRD, you know, which discusses possible variance for lot size. So I just put, you know, that you've got to meet the lot size if you split it, unless there may be a variance that applies, you know, and I put if any, just the choice that it may or may not. And, you know, I think like John saw was this unit apply to more lots than just one.
Well, that's why the whole ordinance reads it's chapter 15.
It's not for taking one lot.
All right, so okay with the commission. I'll close it for public discussion. It's open to commission members right now. Just very quickly, I'm struggling with the definition. We're throwing around too many things. And I've seen this situation in other places where I think there's a much cleaner way of defining what these things are. A attached single unit house is one where you have a split property. Okay, you have a split property, but the units are attached. So when we talk about taking a property and splitting it, we could define that as an attached house. Okay? A townhome is like what we have in the Keys and Curious Village, where you don't have a split property, but you have the ownership, the deeded ownership underneath the structure, but then the surrounding property is common ownership, and we could call that a townhouse. A duplex is where you have an attached structure, but you have common ownership of the underlying property throughout the whole thing. And a condominium would be more than two units by the definition. You know, we can have that, but within the North Carolina. So I think one thing that we're very careful about how we define these things from a nomenclature point of view. It seems to me from your concern, or one of the concerns is that it's simply a different bucket to call these things. If we have a capability of calling it a duplex without changing really the structure, since a duplex is an attached two homes, but you have common ownership of all the land underneath, which is really what these things are. If we could simply create a definition that a two-unit attached structure with common ownership of land we call a duplex here in Town of Curie Beach,
That takes care of your problem. Then you got another box to stick it into. If we can't do that, then we're in a situation of, you know, do we call it a townhome with a deeded underlying property or an attached house where we're separating the lot? That's a different issue, I think.
He's had a great your comments. We have to proceed, I think, very cautiously, because first I would go back, especially when you brought up Robert Colvin, go back and make sure that we've researched what the state has defined all these as. We really know, so we're in common ground with the state, and then come back, make these definitions as we see fit to be able to, I think, help the present, current homeowners and future homeowners out. Let's go back to the state. Let's make sure we're right there. Make sure, in the attorney's viewpoint, we won't have any of these cases where all of a sudden somebody now is going to have a variance or something and they want to try and sell their townhouse or condo because it's got to be converted to a duplex in order to sell. I don't know. I'm not the legal entity here, but I would be very cautious as we perceive that we have those defined fairly well and they correlate with the state, that we're not contradicting ourselves. I would assume the attorneys Culver and Holt here, they should be able to find all that out for us before we proceed. But that sounds like a viable way to go.
That's it. Now it's condos. The whole government sure. All the condos are condos. And the structure just condos. Well, that makes more sense to me. Instead of messing around with the townhouse and making that little area underneath that house common. Why would you do it? And call
them
duplex all the
time. If you can,
because it basically leaves their ownership of that lot.
Same on top of
that.
Right. If you can do that. Yeah.
Then it doesn't really make anybody else not conforming because the people who have the only thing that's not conforming about them would be the condominium if that's even an issue, which it probably is. But I think the best way to go, if you can, is call it duplex.
If I could refer back to John, that y'all, you know, when you throw the condominium into this mix, and I may be mistaken, but it's an entirely different firewall code and all that other stuff, so, you know, please be careful. When you're throwing these definitions around, not to put John or the building inspection department in a position where it's not going to be cut. Because if you call it a condominium, it has an entirely different fire rating and separation and all that stuff. So, you know, it's a little bit more of a basic, I think, than you know, please study this.
I would suggest that we put this on next month's agenda. I mean, certainly I think we fleshed out probably the important issues for Holt and John to look at and come back maybe with a clean recommendation. And it seems to me that there's two issues here. One is, you know, the existing properties that are not built, whether we want to have a mechanism that would allow them to, if they come in and ask for approval of a building, that if they want it as a townhome or a duplex or whatever for just properties that have been built on, versus a mechanism to retrofit basically what is already out there, for example, in your particular case. But I think the issues are, you know, legal and a whole bunch of variance issues right now. Any other comments? To have it on next month's agenda? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Would you like me to have Robert call her again next month to bring a chance?
Just on I think it'd be great as long as there's no cost to the town.
Of course.
Sure.
My only question is, and I understand what you're going through, is what kind of insurance regulations are does this also trigger?
I don't know if there's any regulations that they're actually complaining about. The main comments that I get is that, you know, I'm in this with another guy, and we have three different insurance policies in one building, and it's very expensive.
Oh, I know. I had two online. I got down to one.
They're just speaking off kind of record. I think the insurance companies are doing that wrong. I think if it's technically a condominium, I don't think that you have that you should have separate insurance policies. Now, you could have one for the interior, but I'm pretty sure that probably the condominium association should have an insurance policy for the whole structure.
Well, that's exactly what's going on. Each unit has an insurance policy for the inside and the contents, and then the HOA, which I agree on, has one
for the interior. But that's not what Eric said. You have to have a separate one for the exterior, too.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you probably
have
bad insurance.
Well, actually, no, I have good insurance.
I was very well able to repair the structure, even after my toe, but I knew you garage door.
All right, great. Okay, thank you. All right, agenda item number two is amendment to sign ordinance.
I did my homework again.
Yes, it is actually. I spent all day. Okay, we have two different tasks. Alan, I think, was looking at not conforming the existing signs that are out there, which are not conforming and so forth. You want to talk about that first?
Okay. I basically just went through your list and pulled out. I pulled out the. What would it be one that would be considered non-conforming, and also what would be non-conforming change of the copy signs, and that's the list of signs. So we have. The only thing I thought about after I did this is that the first time I wrote this is this pertains to commercial signs. So yeah, it includes a lot more than B1. Like this list is not conforming.
And it applies to commercial buildings and all zones.
Yeah, so we don't, our list is a little shy. It's not all the time.
It's only going up next
picture. So, how do you think about this? A couple of, I mean, obviously, non-conforming signs, the size is too big compared to what we've come up with for square footage. The issue I found with using the 30% rule, 30% of the sign area to come up with a changeable copy, it doesn't seem to be working very well because it's making a changeable copy of the sign really small. Mm-hmm. You know, just to use an example, Palm here, you know, the changeable copy they have is 18 square feet, and if you measure the sign, 30% of that sign is 9.6 square feet. So, I personally don't think that very changeable copy is too big for the size of that assumption, so which I guess we need, I'm thinking we need to do a little more work on the changeable copy percentage to allow them to be a little bit bigger. And then, of course, we came up with the 8-foot rule, so that makes pretty much all the signs of the town not. And I think we did the 8-foot rule because we wanted to have monument signs. People were going to pull signs. But I think when we set the prohibited stuff, I think we took that out. So we're going to need to amend the height. If we want to allow full signs, then, you know, I prefer a monument sign.
And you heard that
we're just going to make every sign on that wall. Right. Which I don't think is a good issue. I think we should probably try to. You know, again, I'll go back to Palmer sign, Jeff Master sign, and that's a pole sign. I don't think it's an eyesore being a pole sign. Sure, I'd love to see it as a sandblasted exterior lit monument sign, but, you know, we could put that in our ordinance that we do recommend monument signs, but it's really
actually, I think that wasn't that we recommended.
Did we?
And again, that's one of the issues about amortization is that, you know, the idea is what do we want the town to look like 20 years from now? Mm-hmm. You know, and so we can create a non-conforming category, but then give a 15-year amortization, or they have 15 years, let's say, to, you know, mm-hmm. conform to that. So, it's not, certainly, no more could we require people to take down their $12,000 sign, but in a 1-year period.
Right. But, okay. Any other questions about the signage area? My assignment was to look at temporary signs. And what I did is I actually probably spent about 6 hours a day looking at 100 different sign ordinances. I looked at the state seemed to have already some legal challenges regarding political signs, and most of the legal challenges seem to be in California, actually, which isn't surprising if we want to put up a lot of different things. So what I did is I made copies of different, and here's one extra. It's all over the place. Hold the mail. Actually, have this right here. So a lot of these things are driven by legal issues. The simplest one I found, and there's several different things I've kind of walked through here. We'll go through all of it. The simplest one I found actually was in Springfield, Illinois. And what they did is they have a temporary sign ordinance section. Most of them do have a temporary sign ordinance section, talk about it. And basically how they get around the political sign issue is, and this is just the language right here, it's only about, you know, three sentences. It says, temporary signs for events concluding on a specific date may be displayed for a period of 60 days prior to the conclusion of that event. And again, we could, you know, put any time frame there. And then temporary signs for events with no specific date of conclusion may be displayed throughout the event. And then temporary signs must be removed 14 days. What this does is it captures, it doesn't specify political events, it says any event. Okay, whether it's a political event, whether it's a, you know, a fair or a festivity or anything like that. So just by simply putting that, if there's a specific date when it concludes, then there's a period of time prior to that, you can put it up. If there's no specific date, then you can have it during the event. This clearly was the simplest way of dealing with the issue of political sign within a temporary sign ordinance that I could find. What's below, I thought it was pretty good language as a lead-in, because again, there's a lot of legal issues now in terms of temporary signs, so I thought this was a pretty good section I found in Springfield, Illinois, in terms of the lead-in to a temporary sign subsection right there. A couple other interesting things. In the city of Mission Viejo, a very interesting section in their signed ordinance that I just wanted to kind of bring out here, and that's what's called message substitution. And this was obviously put there just very recently because of a legal challenge. And basically it says that as long as the sign conforms, a commercial sign conforms to the size and so forth, its ordinance, you can put any non-commercial message that you want in there. You know, that there's no restriction in terms of what the message is. The restriction has to do with the shape and the size. Now, I should mention that Mission Viejo, since I was chairman of the planning commission there, does not allow pole signs. You know, these are sandblasted monument signs and so forth. But basically, what they've done, obviously, in the last year, I think this is done in 2009, probably on a legal challenge, is that you can put whatever message you want on a sign. And you can read the language that they have in the ordinance. What I did is I tried to look primarily at beach communities that were a combination of tourist and residential. I just got some other ones right here if anybody wants to look at it. This is the temporary sign section for San Clemente, California. There, I got San Juan Capistrano. Again, some of their definitions and what their language is for temporary signs. Civica, California, which is number 5 here, they have actually a separate section for political signs. This is a section separate from temporary signs. And again, as you can see, that I found things all over the table in terms of how to deal with this issue. And again, this is the Pacifica, California definition of political signs, and their summary on that. And this is fairly recent. I believe this is like a 2008 ordinance or something like that. So, but again, as we talked about last time, this may be something to challenge if it's separate from other contemporary sites. That's why I kind of like the Springfield, Illinois one.
And secondly, those are about seven or eight different temporary sign things that I kind of show the range from Springfield, Illinois, of just a very simple couple sentences to even more specific ones. Since we were talking about non-conforming signs, as I said, I probably looked at 100 different sign ordinances. Every single sign ordinance that I saw had a non-conforming section like what we've talked about with an amortization process. The amortization of the signs, the sign ordinances that I saw today, and like I said, it was at least, honestly, probably about 70, possibly up to 100 when I looked at it. The longest I found was 15 years. I didn't find a single one that was 15 years. There was no grandfathering. I couldn't find a single one that was grandfathering. The shortest was 1 year. Okay, and up to a maximum of 15 years. I just copied this one right here. San Luis Obispo, California. Again, a community, beach community, small community, primary residential that has some tourism also. You know, again, I just copied this one here because I thought this was kind of neat. This is an amortization based upon the value of the sign. As you can see right here, they have a schedule on the back. Less than $500, you have 2 years, $599, 3 years, and so forth. But what they did, I thought was kind of interesting, is not the value of the sign, but basically they doubled what the sign cost when it was put in. You double that and then fit within these categories right here. And again, you have to prove it from original bill of sale, description schedule on a state or federal income tax return, written appraisal by sign manufacturer, and so forth. So, of all the ones that I looked at, this seemed to be kind of the cleanest in terms. And again, you can see that the maximum is 10 years of amortization right here on this particular one. So if we want to go to amortization, we may want to have a schedule that looks something like this. But again, as I mentioned, the longest I found was 15 years, the shortest was 1 year. After this, you know, I just found some interesting things. Obviously, different cities have different problems. I believe that John had mentioned that there was an application for a big vending machine made a couple months ago. The ICE, technically, is a big vending machine. Santa Barbara, California has a whole section in their ordinance on vending machines. And, you know, we don't have to go through that. Just the, you know, whether vending machines can be seen and not seen and all that sort of thing. So here's the ordinance for the vending machine. The remaining part of this is overlay districts, which I believe is our last or our next item.
Mine was only a half page.
I actually printed off the individual ordinances too for that. Anyway, just some light reading that I cut yesterday. So
I agree
with it. Is there any further discussion on the sign ordinance? I think the recommendation was that we probably need to kind of push ahead and get this moving forward.
Even if we do it in pieces.
Yeah, either pieces, but I think the issues were the issue of amortization, non-conforming, the issues of political signs and temporary signs. So, do we want to put it on the next month's agenda and actually kind of flesh it out and try to kind of move forward?
I think we could do that with temporary, and then maybe John can get the rest of the sign measurements for the commercial district.
Maybe. For all districts.
Yep. Whatever it is, it's a commercial sign.
Borrow a bulletproof vest.
I mean, if we're going to do it this way, we might as well go for all. For the same thing. I can work on the changeable copy of this.
One of the things I did, we talked about amortization. I did find several of the cities have amortization values based upon the depreciation of the sign on tax returns. I know that has been legally challenged in court, and you can't use depreciation schedules on that. And that's why I used what San Juan Capistrano's definition of value, because I know that you can't use a depreciation value, because that has been challenged. Is there a motion to table the sign ordinance until next month with the understanding that we'll try to push ahead and fine-tune that, perhaps get at least a temporary sign component. Second?
I'll second. I think we should get this temporary one done next month. Even if it's piecemeal, and so we get them all there and get them around.
So anyway, yeah, you might want to look at this, it'll be from now and next month.
Good.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Last thing on all business is impervious services. Alan, I think it's yours.
Actually, it's one of overly district level.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, let me stop. Is it okay? Overlay.
That's my idea.
Overlay district, going through these various municipal ordinances on signs, I was also looking to see if I could find if anybody had overlay districts. Since we're talking about overlay districts. And in fact, there were several that have overlay districts. I won't say that they're common. They seem to be most common in beach communities, actually, or in historic communities. Historic communities or beach communities are trying to do something a little bit different. The most complete one I could actually find was San Clemente, California. They have about six or seven different overlay districts. You can see that they have an architectural overlay district. They have a central business overlay district. They have a planned residential overlay district. And so what I did is I have a central coastal zone overlay district. And so what I did is I cut and pasted in their ordinance regarding the different overlay districts in here to go ahead and look at. Yeah, they have a whole bunch of Inland Canyon overlay districts, special residential overlays, and so forth. The second one is San Luis Obispo overlay districts. They just had one. I think it was a planned development overlay district. This, I thought, was a really good example of how overlay districts are used. Basically, it's an overlay district that we talked about with specifically the overlay district is being used for a combination of different things. Simplest is an overlay district that I saw where they created an overlay district in an area where they wanted to have mixed use. They wanted to have a combination of commercial and residential. But the only thing that was allowed by this overlay district was increased height. And I did want to copy that in here because it needs to be, I could probably leave out and talk about increased height. You can have an overlay district for a very, very specific thing. Very, very specific. I mean, there was an overlay district, you have the only reason for the overlay district was that if you want to do a mixed use, you could go to the planning commission, city council, and ask for an increased height. Other overlay districts were more design-oriented, where you had an overlay district right here, and it's very simple language, like in San Luis Obispo, but then there's reference to a design document that said that in this overlay district, this is what you have in the overlay district, but if you're in this overlay district, then it refers to a separate document that would be the design document in terms of what it has to look like. They have their sidewalk, they have certain landscaping and stuff like that. So you can have overlay districts for very, very specific, narrow use to very complicated design sort of thing. But again, here's some, I think, good language in terms of two examples of overlay districts. Yeah, I guess for the overlay districts, we do have a subcommittee of, I believe, myself and one or two other people. So
three.
Okay. So if it's okay, I want to bring this to the Planning Commission first, but it sounds like the next step then is now we have some language right here is to form that committee and push ahead on the overlay district, at least to keep the Planning Commission up to date in terms of possibly how the language is used in the existing ordinances. Okay. I don't think there's any motion on this. It's just information purposes only. Okay. Last item on your own business is impervious services.
And that was the language that I had was that this two sentence, and he had the last
Yes, Mr. Impervious Surface, it's section 19-3 to 21.5, impervious surface coverage in the side setback area of residential lot shall be limited to 15% of the setback area located in the buildable portion of the lot. Does that sound familiar?
Yes,
that
is it. It probably shouldn't be the buildable portion of the lot. It's just the setback.
In the setback?
Yes. Yeah, it wouldn't have to stay buildable portion of the lot. Because that would be a different area than the setback.
Right, they're kind
that's
of...
inside the setback.
Right. So that's one quick question I had. So it really shall be limited to 15% of the setback area. Okay?
Side setback.
That was a little confusing. So. And then the second part was driveways located in the setback area of residential lots shall be limited to 36 feet in width. I think that would come up from 30 to 36. The question I had there is, as it now reads, it talks about 24, as it ordinance, the ordinance now reads, appears to be 24 feet if it goes across the town right of way.
And that will stay. Yep.
Okay. And then areas in the setback area are 36 feet.
Right. So the driveway's maximum 36 feet wide, and then the duplexes, condos, whatever they are, the 36 feet allows them to split the center of the strip and still give them that parking space.
I think that should be fine with that clarification.
I'm a son of the audience. In your land use plan, it says all residential driveways should be non-porous. Can y'all start addressing that? Not non-porous. But that's in the land use plan, so sometime or another, I'd like to bring that into the circle here.
It's come up on the definition, right?
I forgot the page on Craig, but we can look it up. But it's in the land use plan.
What he's saying is we need to investigate methods for coming about enforcing that.
The percentage of the driveway needs to be lowered, but it's in there that we need to start. I appreciate your checking and start addressing that. As far as this driveway,
that just seems to be the research, but the state's not recognizing any of it, are they?
Well, what the state does is irrelevant. It's our land use plan. It's our land use plan, the Kiri Beach land use plan. So if you want to discuss driveways, just a suggestion, but I will encompass that into the discussion.
What are you talking about, various services for?
That's why we're limiting the driveway width and the setback, 15% setback.
But it's already in the land use plan, so...
So is the issue whether this recommended change is consistent with the land use plan? Is that?
No, by your own discussion, try to incorporate what's in the land use plan as far as what you're
working. So bigger picture, look at a bigger picture.
Because if we're going to discuss it, particularly in council, it'd be great to prefer, in all these instances, you're supposed to refer back to make sure it is consistent with the land use plan. Mm-hmm. And that is in the land use plan now. So please, if y'all kind of pull that in our vision before it comes to council.
So you want to include, well, this kind of complicates the whole thing, though.
Well, it always is.
That's why y'all get the big bucks.
And any of this stuff is always supposed to, incorporate what we have in the land use plan.
Well, it does, because I think limiting your driveway to 36 feet instead of 50 feet is supported by the land use plan because it's preferred density and trying to control density. So, I mean, what we have on the table now is supported by the layman's plan. But we could also look into impervious.
Yeah, it,
because it says that we will have impervious driveway. But that could be separate.
Yeah, let's get right. Impervious is just regular concrete. Pervious.
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 Pervious. At least
right there. Maybe you're moving down through it.
Well, I think the issue that Dean raises is that do we want to go ahead and make a motion on this and send it to the council with an understanding that this itself is consistent with the land use plan, or do we want to wait till next month, look at the land use plan, and create language possibly in this motion to make it even more consistent?
If you're going to make a change, I would really like to make it consistent with, I mean, you know, okay, let's
make one change.
Make sure it's thoroughly, make sure from now on that if you do pour a driveway, and I understand what you're trying to do, Al, which I agree with you, but if we want to, you know, discuss driveways, let's, you know, get the big picture with the land use plan and start putting them in the way we say we're going to do it.
I guess the only issue that I have, I think it's going to take longer than just a little bit of research, because we have communities, we have parts of this island where they have 1,680 square foot impervious surface because of a lot.
Right.
If the town adopts pervious surface, then are they going to come to us and say, okay, we've got a pervious driveway, we can have a bigger house?
Yeah, they'll give you a percentage on that, that's correct.
So, I mean, so there's a lot more to it than just,
yeah, you need to know this is coming up,
get your big picture,
and we go together through this.
What's your baby? What would you recommend? I think we should send through what we have, and then also put on our agenda that we're going to look into a pervious surface to drive this. Because part of the separate, this basically controls density, it controls people covering their properties with complete concrete.
This could stop some
flooding. Whether it's pervious or not, it still stops people from covering their property with concrete and having cars popped up the sides of properties and stuff.
And then this proposal is not inconsistent with the land use plan.
I hope they do that.
It isn't. It could support it further if we dig deeper.
Right.
And we could always add to it, I guess, or change it again if you want.
And if you're going to go into the effort, try to get it all one time.
Well, I mean, would pervious surface even be in the same chapters?
That's,
yeah. This one?
19321. I think we have to define driveways, make it into the pervious surface. Because we wouldn't want to be that loophole, as you said, with the. Well, now that I've got a purpose driveway, I can build a 70 more square feet on my property.
Yeah, but you know, like I said, my only suggestion is, since it's in the land use plan, try to incorporate that into what y'all are doing so that it will be, you know, we'll get the whole thing done at one time instead of somebody bringing it up later because it's in there.
Is there a motion?
One observation, I certainly see how it's related, but in terms of the ordinance this falls under, I was just looking at this introductory paragraph. It talks about no building repairs, remodeling, installation, driveway, parking lot, or other ground covering impervious surfaces shall begin without a permit. And then the permit shall be issued, then it goes on from there. So it looks like it'll need to be changed or broadened or something a little bit, because this particular section is just talking about getting a permit to do impervious. So, I mean, I just want you to be aware of that in terms of going forward, because it would affect.
Well, I'm going to see if I can get that done. If y'all remember, a couple years ago, we had a guy come and do a presentation for us. I want to see if I can get him up here again. Maybe that'll.
Well, I think you're going up there, and that's, you know, what's the driveway that
didn't
happen.
And
if everybody knows about that, then everybody knows that it's really not worked as well.
That's my whole issue is that it's going to take us a while to come up with pervious surface. So that's why I would make a motion to send this through.
And then just work
directly on the pervious surface. I mean, we could even combine with stormwater, come up with something. I mean, because the perfect surface isn't part of stormwater, too. It's stormwater runoff. So it's something that both committees could be working on and get together and come up with one.
Is there a motion for
What's the language we have right before us on this?
The language that has been recommended for the change, it would be impervious surface coverage in the side setback area of residential lot shall be limited to 15% of the side setback. And then driveways located in the setback area of residential lots shall be limited to 36 feet in width.
That's my motion. Okay, so this motion. Okay, open for discussion. Sounds good. Discussion. Just very quickly, I think taking Dean's comments to heart, I think we should send this on as it is because it deals with an impervious surface issue. The land use plan deals with a pervious sort of thing. That is a broader issue where we can look at materials and stuff like that. But I think this takes care of a very, very narrow, very specific issue that fits within the spirit of the land use plan. So, all in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion passes.
So do we want to put the pervious surface on
the agenda?
Yes.
Yes. So ahead and put pervious surfaces on new business.
Something else you need to do, John, while you're measuring signs. Don't forget your Rice Krispie tree.
Recycle on your neighbor's items to see what you got stolen from it.
All right.
You can kick out of getting a job to do stuff.
New business, commission vacancy. It's the tradition that we do take our vote in public session here. Are there any motions? We have one vacancy for the commission. Are there any motions?
I think all the applicants it's a tough decision. I mean, I thought I'd narrow it down to the two that said, which was Jim and Tony.
I'll put a motion on the Jim Card.
Second.
You second.
Okay, that's open for discussion. We have a motion that's been seconded for Jim Carter. My comment is I think Jim brings, if you look at what he brings to the table in terms of his knowledge and his understanding and his vision, regarding planning and zoning issues, I think he's the best of the ones that we look at. I think Tony certainly excels.
I think I interjected last night when talking about proper synergy, and I said that doesn't show my interest in what's going on.
Okay. Again, this is a recommendation, obviously, to the town council, and that's all that it is. It's a recommendation. Okay. All in favor of recommending Jim Barter as the appointment to the vacancy on the Planning and Zoning Committee, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Okay, the appointment of vice chair. We didn't appoint one last time?
No. It's
only for you.
Do you want to carry this on? I plan on being here, so, I'll let.
So, we have to make sure that the council wants him before we.
No, I was going to say, you want to carry this on as old business. Let's go ahead and table all in favor.
Aye.
Okay, so table, one of the vice chair that brings the member items. Alan, any member items?
I'd like to go last.
Oh, okay.
I have
no member items.
I have no
member items.
I
didn't
have
a
sorry.
John, sorry.
Okay, is there a motion for adjournment?
Motion.
Second.
Very good.
Aye. Great meeting. Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Greg.
you, Joe.
Joe, you ran more than this.
We did the things.
Five of the four afterwards.
No, I didn't let you hear it.
And if you didn't, take them off, Peter.
Nobody gave an angry response, so we don't have any response.
Okay, good deal.
Hopefully I'll be in.